Prisoners got the usual rice and beans. Matthew gave one fish to each of them. Even with the heads on, they were barely enough to add a little flavor to the rice. Yesterday, it had rained all day, so they didn't go fishing. This afternoon, however, the sun was shining, and the gorillas were hungry for more trout. They'd found another safety pin, and Matthew rigged up a second line with more canvas thread. He told them he couldn't watch both lines at once without risk of losing one of them, so they let him bring along a fishing buddy. The prisoners drew straws to see who could go. The Swede won. They left camp after lunch and returned to the same eddy, about a 15-minute walk. Four guards went this time because of the extra prisoner. For added security, they chained the prisoners together at their ankles. Aida and her boyfriend perched themselves atop a rock in the sun. They were soon groping each other. The two other gorillas entertained themselves with a Spanish-language travel book that Joaquin had taken from the guide who'd led the Japanese tourists into trouble. Every few minutes, they hooted with laughter, pointing at yet another passage that read, "This area is safe for tourists." Travel books were like the kidnapper's guide to hunting and fishing. In 30 minutes, Matthew had caught 11 trout. The Swede hadn't caught any.
"Will you stop making me look bad?" said Jan.
"You're doing fine. Just be patient.
Don't patronize me. These gorillas are going to think I'm worthless."
Matthew smiled, thinking he was kidding, but Jan's expression was tense and deadly serious.
"Lighten up, all right?" "How do you expect me to lighten up? Can't you see I'm next on their list?"
"What list?" Jan lowered his voice as if to make double sure that the guards couldn't overhear.
"Their list of expendables."
Matthew glanced toward Aida and her boyfriend. They'd moved from atop the rock to the bushes behind it.
"You're giving these punks too much credit. They don't make lists." "Go ahead, brush it off. You're now their fair-haired boy, Mr. Fisherman. But me, I'm just Will's friend. Will, the pain in the ass."
"They're not going to kill you just because of that."
"You heard what the flea man said. Joaquin's group has enough guards to handle 5 or 6 prisoners, tops. With this new Japanese couple, we have 7 now."
"He also said Joaquin eliminates only the ones who look like they won't pay off. Will was stupid. He flaunted the fact that his family wouldn't pay."
"That wasn't just a pact he'd entered into with his wife. That's the philosophy of our whole company. Will and I got extra pay to come to Colombia, but we knew that if we were kidnapped, the company wouldn't pay."
"Joaquin doesn't have to know that."
"He'll know soon enough. I'm not married. I don't have a wife or family to come up with the money to get me out of here. Joaquin is sure to make a ransom demand on my company, and they won't pay."
Matthew lowered his eyes. A trout was skimming the surface, flirting with his hook.
"You don't know that for sure." "Management thinks exactly the way Will did. I'm telling you because I trust you. My only way out of here is on my own 2 feet.
"You mean an escape?" Matthew whispered. Jan made a face, as if saying it would jinx things.
"If I stay, I'm a dead man. And you're in the same boat."
"Why do you say that?"
"These little underlings might like you now that you're catching fish for them, but Joaquin, he's got a score to settle with you. That gorilla who got killed in the shootout on your boat in Cartagena was one of his best men."
Matthew froze for an instant. He hadn't told anyone about Cartagena.
"How did you know about that?" "I keep my ears open. The guards talk plenty."
Matthew said nothing, thinking.
"So, you with me or not, fisherman?"
Again, Matthew lowered his eyes toward the fish. It was about to bite, then swam away from the hook.
"I can't."
"Why not?"
"I have responsibilities here."
"What?"
"The 2 young Colombians. When Joaquin took us back from FARC, he said he'd kill Emilio if I tried to escape. He'll kill Rosa if I succeed." "It's a bluff. He won't kill 2 prisoners with families willing to pay." "I can't risk it."
"Don't be a fool. You need to look out for 1. You said your wife is pregnant, right? Your family needs you."
That was true, in part. The family needed him. The new family, anyway. The baby who might never know his father. It would have been easy for Matthew to feel sorry for himself, but he felt even worse for the much younger parents who might never see any of their children grow. Matthew had been blessed with the chance to raise two children to adulthood. Sometimes he'd felt as though he'd screwed it up. Often he wished he were closer to his children. But there was no denying he'd been given the chance. Whether he deserved a second one, he couldn't say. "I just can't run out of here at someone else's expense."
"They'd do it to you, my friend. This is the law of the jungle, survival of the fittest."
"I told you I can't."
"All right. I'm on my own. But think about it, will you?"
"Sure," he said. But he knew that escape wasn't an option. It wasn't even necessary. Maybe Joaquin was angry about the shootout in Cartagena, but in the end, a ransom payment would surely ease his grief and erase whatever anger he felt toward Matthew. Joaquin loved money, and Matthew's insurance company had plenty to give. But why was it taking so long? "Just hope I picked a good company," he thought, as he turned away from Jan and refocused on his fishing. Chapter 29. The week ended as it had begun, with me headed for a meeting with Duncan Fitz. This time it wasn't going to be the folksy chat in his office. I'd been summoned to the private conference room adjacent to the Miami managing partner's suite, and the bad vibes had already started in the lobby. The receptionist greeted me pleasantly, but the moment I'd passed, I got the strange sense that she'd picked up the phone to alert someone I was on my way. Secretaries seemed unusually busy, typing or filing, no time to look up from their desks and say hello. A partner emerged from his office, saw me coming, and went right back inside. It seemed as though everyone had decided that my family had defrauded a client. "Seemed," I chided myself, "you're getting paranoid." I wasn't sure what Duncan had been thinking since the unpleasant ending to our meeting on Monday morning. My first clue came from his secretary in the form of a bare-bones email telling me where to be and when to be there. Of course, the meeting would deal with the insurance coverage issue, but beyond that, I'd been told nothing. That was the norm at Cool Cash. As a rule, news from the management committee leaked first to certain secretaries, then to partners, next to the associates at large, and lastly to the poor slob most directly affected by the action. I checked my watch, 10 a.m., right on time. I turned the final corner, started down the hall, and slammed right into Duncan Fitz's secretary, knocking her files to the floor. "Gosh, I'm sorry," I said.
"It's okay, my fault."
Beverly was a sweet but plain-looking divorced woman in her late 30s who had given up her social life for the benefit of Duncan Fitz, which meant working till 8 o'clock every night, a full day on Saturdays and a fair number of Sundays. She was the most efficient and organized person I'd ever met. Every day she worked through a lunch that consisted of either an orange or a banana, one granola bar, and the latest Live Forever vitamin cocktail that she'd ordered online from a health food website. She didn't have many friends at the firm, or, for that matter, outside the firm. The only photographs at her workstation were of cats, especially a big white one with awesome green eyes. Maybe it was because I'd always made a point of asking how Puffy was doing, but for some reason she'd always liked me. "I can't believe I did this," I said. We were kneeling and facing each other, scooping up the scattered papers from the floor. In the midst of the cleanup, she stopped so suddenly that I stopped too. She looked me in the eye and whispered,
"Be careful what you say in there. I've seen the memos."
She tucked the reassembled files under her arm as if to end our conversation right there. "Thank you," I said, rising. With her eyes, she seemed to say, "Good luck." Then she continued down the hall without another word. I took a deep breath, knocked on the conference room door, and entered on command. Dark suits were the order of the day. Seated at the conference table were three men dressed in various shades of navy blue, plus one woman wearing charcoal gray with burgundy accents. Duncan Fitz was at the far end, nearest the window. Sid Templeton, the managing partner of the Miami office, was at his side. The other two I didn't recognize. "Martin Rush,"
said the man. Chairman of the Ethics and Conflicts Committee. With the accent, he didn't have to tell me he was down from the New York office. He seemed tightly wound, a compulsive jogger, I imagined. Wiry body, thin face, hair cropped a little too short, the red bow tie a bit too tight.
Maggie Johannes, said the other.
I'd never seen her face before, but from the name alone, I immediately recognized her as the lawyer Duncan had called in New York to help me, the partner who served as Quality's general counsel.
Please have a seat.
She was evidently taking the lead, which didn't bode well.
Thank you.
I glanced at Duncan and Sid Templeton as I settled into my chair, trying to get a sense of any sign of support from the Miami contingent. Sid glanced out the window. Duncan lowered his eyes.
Maggie said, This committee has been assembled to determine the proper response of our law firm to the dispute that has arisen between Quality Insurance Company and the Ray family. In making that determination, we wanted to afford you an opportunity to express your views.
Are you sure you want to hear my views?
Why wouldn't we?
She asked. Because my family has been accused of fraud.
That's true.
My view is that the accusation is baseless. Quality Insurance Company has acted in bad faith, and I hope that somebody makes them pay for the added stress they've put on my mother and for every additional minute my father spends in captivity because of their refusal to pay the ransom. She and the other New Yorker exchanged glances. Duncan shot me a look as if warning me to tone it down a notch. The skinny ethics chairman asked, Is it your intention to sue a client of this law firm? I measured my response, mindful of Duncan's nonverbal admonition. I hope it doesn't come to that. Sid Templeton, the Miami managing partner, jumped in. Before everybody gets their back up, can we simply talk a few things out?
Sure, I said.
Whenever there's a disagreement, I find it helpful to stand in the shoes of the other person. If you'll bear with me, Nick, you may gain some insights as to where the insurance company is coming from.
I'm all for that. Sid cleared his throat, then began.
Your father was a fisherman for almost 30 years, correct?
That's right.
He never had kidnap and ransom insurance?
No.
Finally, he buys a $3 million policy, and bam, not much later, he's kidnapped. That's a red flag for an insurance company, wouldn't you agree?
I suppose it might be.
Sid shrugged, as if giving me an opportunity to explain away the suspicion. Before I could say a word, Maggie took over the line of questioning.
Why did your father purchase $3 million worth of coverage?
Maybe that was the most he could afford.
Let me ask the more pertinent question. Why do you think the kidnappers demanded exactly $3 million in ransom?
The dollar amount of the ransom is part of an ongoing confidential negotiation. Unless the insurer intends to pay it, I prefer not to share that information.
You already told Duncan it was $3 million.
I looked at Duncan with surprise. Obviously, nothing we'd talked about on Monday had been kept confidential, or friend to friend, as he had promised. I don't know why the kidnappers demanded $3 million. You'll have to ask them.
Or your father, she said.
What are you implying?
It hardly seems coincidental that the ransom demand is in the exact amount of coverage.
First of all, that doesn't mean my father defrauded anybody. Second, the insurance company didn't even know that the ransom demand matched the policy limit until after it denied the claim as fraudulent.
Young man, said Mr. Ethics,
what prompted your father to purchase kidnap and ransom insurance after going without it for 30 years?
Circumstances change. Kidnapping for ransom is more prevalent these days, and I would imagine that my mother's pregnancy had something to do with it. He started to think like a future father again.
So he jumped on his boat and headed for Colombia? That doesn't sound like the responsible future father.
In hindsight, I'm sure he wishes he hadn't gone.
Maggie narrowed her eyes, leaning closer.
Of all the companies out there, what made him choose Quality Insurance Company?
I don't know.
Was it your recommendation?
No, I said, surprised by the question.
Did you tell your father that Quality might look more favorably on his claim, given your association with his law firm?
Absolutely not,
Did you tell your father that you would use the partners in this law firm to pressure the insurance company into paying the claim?
That's absurd.
Then why did you ask Duncan Fitch to call me and use my influence with Quality?
Duncan offered to call you. I didn't ask. Tell her, Duncan.
He answered in a hollow voice, "As I recall, Nick, you came to me."
"Yes, and you offered to help,"
Sid intervened.
"It should be made clear that no one is suggesting that Duncan knowingly participated in any kind of scheme to defraud."
"There was no scheme by anyone," I said. "The only thing motivating me or Duncan was the fact that my father was kidnapped and needed help, period."
No one seemed convinced, least of all the New Yorkers.
"Is that what this is about?" I said. "You think I told my father to buy a kidnap and ransom policy from Quality Insurance so that I could scam them?"
There was no answer. But I could see where this was headed, me and my father co-conspirators. The warning from Duncan's secretary was ringing in my ear. "Be careful what you say in there. I've seen the memos."
"This is a sham. You don't care what my views are. You've already made your decision,"
Maggie said. "I assure you, we came here with an open mind. We had sincerely hoped to hear something from you that would allow a course of action other than the one we must now recommend to the management committee."
"Exactly what is your recommendation?"
"Suspension without pay until the dispute is resolved."
"Why?"
Mr. Ethics scoffed.
"Your failure to see the reason only underscores the urgency of our recommendation."
"How do you expect me to get the help my father needs with no income?"
"It's my understanding that the FBI works for free," Maggie said dryly. "At least for families who aren't defrauding insurance companies."
I could have argued with her, but I saw no upside in explaining that the point of contention between my family and the FBI was not alleged insurance fraud, but suspected drug smuggling out of Nicaragua. I rose and looked each one of them in the eye, allowing my glare to linger a little longer on Duncan.
"This is far from over," I said,
shaking hands with no one as I left the room.
Chapter 30. Suspended. That was the word that stuck in my mind when I woke Saturday morning once the initial anger had passed. I reminded myself that my ego was secondary, that the real fight was for my father. But it was hard not to take a betrayal like this personally, especially from Duncan Fitz, a guy who'd given me nothing but glowing reviews from the day I'd started working for him. I wondered what the party line would be on my suspension. The firm couldn't announce that I'd been suspended for pressing a fraudulent claim on a kidnap and ransom policy. Quality prohibited anyone, including its own lawyers, from disclosing the existence of kidnap and ransom insurance. Of necessity, the explanation for my departure would be vague, which would only invite salacious speculation on Miami's legal grapevine. Soon, the poor guy whose father had been kidnapped in Colombia would be known only as the idiot associate over at Cool Cash who'd been suspended for sleeping with the managing partner's 16-year-old daughter and kicking a blind cocker spaniel. I could fight rumors, but on the more serious front, I wasn't sure who was the more formidable opponent, the Colombian guerrillas or Quality Insurance Company. Battling alone was foolhardy. I needed help. Since Tuesday's uncomfortable encounter at Duffy's Tavern, I'd left Alex alone to cool off. On Saturday morning, I phoned her at home to find out where she stood. I half expected her to hang up on me, but to my surprise, she suggested we meet for lunch at the News Cafe on South Beach, near her apartment. I jumped at the invitation. "See you there," I said, hanging up before she could reconsider. I didn't get to Miami Beach often. It was only a few miles away, but traffic made the trip from Coral Gables only slightly less difficult than leaping across the Grand Canyon. Each time I went, however, I vowed to make a point of going more often. Beneath a perfect blue sky, with warm breezes blowing in from the ocean, South Beach was one of the reasons to live in South Florida. The News Cafe was a popular sidewalk cafe on the corner of Ocean Boulevard and 7th Street. If not the heart of South Beach, at least its left ventricle.
Any outside table was prime entertainment, ideal for spotting a Brazilian supermodel, the dance troupe from the latest Latin MTV video, or morbid tourists headed for a macabre Kodak moment on the very steps where Johnny Versace had been gunned down. Street traffic was typically bumper to bumper, a slow parade of expensive convertibles, motorcycles, and rolling boomboxes that blasted out a variety of music, some that made you want to get up and move to the beat, some that made you want to get up and move to Iowa. Across the boulevard was a grassy park with palm trees and volleyball courts, and then there was the famous sandy beach beyond. Scantily clad skaters maneuvered around pedestrians with the skill of slalom skiers, weaving in and out, excusing the occasional brush of a sweaty body with a glib, "Sorry, dude." Alex showed up just seconds behind me, dressed in capri pants, a sleeveless blouse, and Chanel sunglasses. It was definitely the kind of look that would have turned my head if she'd been a stranger just passing by. We found a table in the shade of an umbrella, and the waiter brought us sparkling water with lemon. She seemed to be waiting for me to start the real conversation. "I'm almost surprised you came," I said. "Why?" "Things have taken a turn for the worse at my law firm. I thought you'd be even more concerned than ever about someone from Quality Insurance seeing us together." "Trust me, that doesn't matter anymore." I sipped my bottled water, reluctant to ask the logical question. "Is that because you're done with me?" "No, it's because Quality Insurance fired me."
"From my case, you mean?"
She removed her sunglasses to reveal the serious expression in her eyes.
"They terminated my retainer agreement. They'll never send me another case."
I grimaced, knowing it was my fault. "I swear I didn't tell anyone you were helping me."
"I told them myself."
"Why?"
"After you and I got together at Duffy's, they confronted me. Apparently someone saw us there together."
"That's so weird. As you were leaving, I sensed someone was watching us."
"Might have been someone from your law firm, but whoever it was has a pipeline to the General Counsel for Quality Insurance."
"That's because the GC is also a partner in our New York office."
"Kind of incestuous, isn't it?"
"Tell me about it. So Maggie Johannes called you?"
"Yeah. Wanted to know what the hell I was doing fraternizing with the enemy."
"What did you tell her?"
"That I didn't agree with the company's decision to deny coverage and that I intended to continue helping you on my own terms."
"Damn, Alex. You should have said you were pumping me for information, setting me up for their benefit."
"Is that what you would have done?"
I thought for a second, then said, "No, but I still feel terrible. Quality Insurance has to be a huge source of business for you to lose."
"Don't worry about that."
"I do worry. If helping me is going to cost you an entire book of business, that's a debt I can't ever repay."
"I didn't come here to hand you a bill. If anything, I came because I felt like I was the one who owes you."
"Owes me what?"
She lowered her eyes and said, "An apology for the way I acted at Duffy's the other night."
"You had a right to be mad."
"No. I should never have opened my mouth and accused you of playing games. Whatever is going on between you and your ex-fiancé is your business."
"There's nothing going on between me and Jenna."
"That's not the point. I was letting my personal feelings get in the way."
She caught me in mid-sip, and I nearly choked. "You mean for me?"
"No, I mean for Duffy's beer and popcorn. Yes, of course for you, dummy."
"When you say personal feelings, do you mean—"
"I'm not head over heels, okay? We've simply been spending a lot of time together lately, and would you please stop being so obtuse?"
"I just had no idea."
"I wasn't exactly trying to make it obvious, given our professional relationship."
"I'm sorry, I just didn't think that, you know, you and me—"
"Now you're lying."
I wasn't accustomed to this kind of directness, but in a way it was refreshing. "Okay, so maybe I was sensing a little something, but there's nothing to apologize for."
"That's where you're wrong. Your father was kidnapped, and I offered to help. It's totally unprofessional for me to inject anything else into that equation."
"Well, maybe you should let me be the judge of that."
"No."
I waited for her to elaborate, but she didn't. "That's it?" I asked. "A simple no?"
"What more is there to say? You have my word that I won't send any more confusing signals."
I nodded, though the present signals were plenty confusing. "If that's the way you want it."
"I've thought about it all week. On principle, I refuse to back down and dump your case. I won't let any insurance company dictate my client list to me.
I can respect that.
Then I'm sure you'll understand that the only way I can be effective is if we agree to keep things strictly professional.
I was speechless. Here was an intelligent, beautiful woman, confessing a vague but potentially romantic interest in me, and I'd been too wrapped up in my own world to recognize the signs. To be sure, a kidnapping could have made any man oblivious. My fear, however, was that the real hang-up was still Jenna.
I can live with that, I said.
Good.
But if you're sticking with me on principle, you need to be aware that this is going to be a dogfight. From what the lawyers at my firm said yesterday, they might even accuse me of being a co-conspirator in the fraud.
I'm not worried about that. I've checked you out.
What does that mean?
Exactly what I said. You're not the type to scam an insurance company.
I'm glad you think so. But the way the ransom demand matched the policy limit right down to the last dollar, I'd probably be suspicious of you if the tables were turned.
Did you make that list I told you to make?
List?
Anyone who would have known your father's travel plans and who might have known he had insurance.
I've mulled it over in my head, but I can't say I've physically made a list.
Let me help you. Did your father pay for the policy out of his own pocket? Or did he get it through his company?
I believe he bought it himself.
The reason I ask is because insurance is the kind of thing he might have discussed with his partners. Oftentimes, employees try to get their company to pay for it.
You're suggesting that Guillermo might have set him up?
I'm saying that his partners might have known about the insurance. It's up to you to figure out if they set him up.
I'll look into it, I said.
I recommend it, highly.
Why? I asked, half kidding. Did you check out Guillermo, too?
She smiled thinly, almost imperceptibly. Then she put on her sunglasses and turned her gaze toward the joggers across the street, as if she'd said enough. I watched her, intrigued. One minute she was direct and assertive, bold enough to bear her feelings. The next, she was a mysterious cipher pointing me toward Nicaragua. It was possible that she'd targeted Guillermo purely as a matter of deductive reasoning. I couldn't help but wonder, however, if something more was behind her suggestion. Something that, for some reason, she wasn't telling me.
I'll definitely check it out, I said, staring at her nebulous reflection in my tall, empty glass.
Chapter 31. Monday morning was perfect for windsurfing. Sunny and 80 degrees, surf temperature almost as high, a steady breeze from the southeast. Not bad, considering that at least 50 million Americans to the north were already scuffle deep in fallen leaves and wiping frost off their pumpkins. I strapped the board atop the roll bars on my Jeep, drove to Biscayne Bay, and took off. Key Biscayne is an island southeast of downtown Miami, and the relatively flat, shallow bay waters off the causeway that link it to the mainland are practically in the shadows of the office towers on Brickell Avenue. As I skimmed across the waves, chances were excellent that several of my colleagues at Cool Cash were peering out the window from 30 stories up, wishing they were that lucky guy windsurfing out on the bay. I could have waved, or flipped them the bird. It seemed like a fitting way to begin my suspension. As teenagers, J.C. and I had gone out on the bay every Saturday, a couple of 13-year-old studs in our own minds. Our not-so-secret desire was to meet that girl in the opening credits of Miami Vice, the one in the skimpy bikini whose board is knifing through the water at 30 miles an hour when she arches that incredible body, throws her head back, soaks her long blonde hair in the bay, and keeps right on going. The bay was a great escape from school, the world, the hassles of being a teenager, and from my father. Finding my own passion on the water was a convenient way of telling him that the disastrous fishing trip we'd taken together was going to be our first and last. At age 12, I'd seen a side of him that I never wanted to see again. So I decided I'd never be alone with him again, at least not in a setting where he was not just my father, but the captain of the ship. A drunken captain of the ship. Seeing him that way had been bad enough. What he'd done that day changed us forever.
As I packed my equipment back onto my jeep, I realized that the old wounds were very much a part of the pain and personal strife that had been brought on by the kidnapping.
"Lemonade, friend?"
I turned at the sound of the man's voice. It was Nate, a cheery old guy who in the past 20 years had peddled his frozen lemonade cart up and down the bicycle path enough times to circle the globe. Business today was so slow that he couldn't break a 20, so I let him keep the change. That was only fair. He didn't recognize me, but JC and I probably owed him at least $100 for all the frozen lemonades he'd let us put on our tab. I climbed into my jeep and was about to start the engine when another voice startled me. "Can we talk, Nick?" He was right beside my jeep, but with the sun shining directly in my eyes, I wasn't 100% sure on the ID. "Agent Nettles?" I said, squinting. "In the flesh." Nettles had been the initial FBI agent assigned to my father's case. I hadn't heard from him since the narcotics arm of the FBI had seemingly taken over. "What's there to talk about?" "Your father's case, of course." I released the parking brake, letting him know that I was leaving. "Look, you were much nicer than the drug agents who interrogated me, but I'm giving you the same answer I gave them. I think it's wrong for the FBI to tell me they won't help my father unless I play spy and help your narcotics agents pin some unspecified crime on his business partner." "I agree with you." That took me by surprise. "Then why did Agent Hardass give me the come-to-Jesus speech?" "Not every cowboy who thinks he talks for the entire FBI actually talks for the entire FBI. Are you saying that the FBI is now willing to help? No conditions? When your father comes home, you can bet that Agent Hewitt will have a good long talk with him, but it's my job to get him home, regardless of whether you or anyone else in your family agrees to cooperate in any future investigation against anyone." "Why the sudden reversal?"
"Let's just say there was an internal disagreement. We finally straightened it out."
"Or maybe it's just the old good cop, bad cop strategy. I wouldn't bow to threats from Agent Hewitt, so you politely insinuate yourself back into the kidnapping negotiations, work closely with our family, and snoop around while you're at it."
"That's not what this is about."
"Why should I believe you?"
"What choice do you have?"
We locked eyes for a moment, until the sun shining behind him finally forced me to look away. If I hadn't had Alex in my camp, I might have jumped at the offer, but I had to remember that this was the same guy who'd stonewalled me when the FBI had declined the State Department's invitation to work on my father's kidnapping. "I'll think about it," I said, then started up my jeep and drove away.
This ends Disc 5. A King's Ransom, Disc 6.
I spent the rest of the afternoon at my house in Coconut Grove, then headed over to my mother's for dinner. Since the kidnapping, I'd made a point of dropping by at least once a day to see her, and tonight she was in the mood to cook. Hearts of palm salad and grilled salmon with dill sauce beat the heck out of a cold bologna sandwich, so who was I to stop her? I let myself in and found a note on the refrigerator saying that she was at the grocery store. Mom was a great cook, but not a great planner. It seemed that no meal was complete without an emergency run to Gardner's Market for some missing ingredient. I helped myself to a soda, flopped on the couch with the newspaper, and turned straight to the America's section of the Miami Herald. Before the kidnapping, I used to skim right past it, but now I had a keen interest in the Colombian Army's latest clash with guerrillas or the most recent bombing by paramilitary forces. I heard Mom's car pull up, the dull thud of a closing car door, the click of her heels coming up the sidewalk. It sounded as if she were running. The front door flew open. She burst inside and slammed it shut. I turned to see her with her back against the door, clutching her bag of groceries.
"Someone followed me home," she said in a nervous voice.
"What?" She quickly headed for the kitchen. I followed. Her hands were shaking as she dropped the bag of groceries on the counter.
"A man in a blue car, I swear. He tailed me all the way from Gardner's."
"Did you recognize him?"
"No, never saw him before."
I had a quick thought. Could it have been Agent Nettles from the FBI?
No, this man was white.
Could have been Hewitt, but in her state of near panic, now wasn't the time to tell her about the bullies in the FBI's narcotics squad. Is he still out there?
I don't know, I ran inside.
What kind of car was it?
I can't say, maybe a Ford. Do you think it could be a messenger for the kidnappers?
Before I could answer, there was a knock at the door.
"Don't answer it,"
my mother said. For 30 seconds, we didn't move. Another knock followed, harder this time. I looked at Mom and said, "Wait here."
"Nick, no."
I walked to the window and pulled the drapes away from the window frame only far enough to peer out. A blue Ford was parked across the street. Just the sight of it had my blood boiling, the nerve of this creep to follow my mother home. My dad had a Smith & Wesson revolver in the bedroom, but I had a sense that the axe handle he'd always kept hanging behind the refrigerator might set a more proper tone. "Call the police," I said. She picked up the phone. I grabbed the axe handle and started for the back door.
"Where are you going?"
"I can't just open the door and let him in. I'll walk around to the front and confront him."
"Please, wait for the police."
"How dangerous can he be? He rang the doorbell."
"So did the Boston Strangler."
"I'll be right back." Over my mother's pleas, I opened the door and stepped out, axe handle gripped firmly. I hurried across the back patio, turned at the corner of the house, headed up the side yard, and stopped at the front of the garage. From there, I could see the Ford across the street. I could hear it, too. The motor was running. I took another step forward and looked across our front lawn. A short guy in a baseball cap was standing in our front porch. He was smaller than me. A good thing. I approached with as much bravado as I could muster and stopped at the base of the steps. "What do you want?" I asked pointedly. He nearly jumped. I'd caught him by surprise. "Are you Matthew Ray?" "No, I'm his son. Who are you?" He reached inside his shirt. "Don't move," I shouted. In a flash, he threw something that hit me in the chest. He leaped off the porch and sprinted across the lawn. I tried to catch him, but I'd gotten a slow start, and this kid was lightning. In a matter of seconds, he was inside his car. The motor was already running. He slammed it into gear and squealed away. I tried to get the license plate number, but missed it. I walked back to the front porch and found what he'd thrown at me. It was an envelope stuffed with papers. I opened it and immediately realized what had just happened. The guy was a process server. Someone must have told him that we'd try to avoid accepting service of court papers, so he'd planned a sneak attack. My shock turned to anger as I saw the caption in black and white, "Quality Insurance Company versus Matthew Ray," it read. They were suing my father. Even more infuriating, 2 separate subpoenas commanded my father and me to appear in Miami-Dade Circuit Court at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning for an emergency hearing. The gall! Dad was in a jungle held captive for ransom by Colombian guerrillas, and they had an emergency. I flipped to the last page to see who the lawyer was, though this kind of legal maneuvering left little doubt as to the perpetrator. Still, it nearly sent me spinning to see the name and address of my own law firm in the signature block, and above the signature line, the familiar scrawl of my supervising partner, Duncan Fitz. "You son of a bitch," I said quietly. "I'll give you an emergency." I folded up the papers and went back inside the house. Chapter 32. It was less than 2 hours till sunset, and they'd been marching since dawn. Joaquin and 2 others led the way through the jungle thicket with machetes, followed by 3 more guerrillas armed with AK-47s. The 3 Colombian prisoners were next, the young mother and father first, then the flea man. Close behind them were 3 more armed guards and the Japanese couple, the newest prisoners. 2 more guerrillas followed, with Matthew and the Swede. 4 guerrillas brought up the rear, the best shooters in the bunch. Their shooting skills were no secret. Yesterday afternoon, they trotted out the prisoners to watch their target practice, not just to show off, but to make their point. If any of them were thinking about an escape, they'd have to outrun a team of sharpshooters who could blow a Coke bottle off a stump at a distance of 100 meters. The demonstration wasn't exactly a lift to anyone's spirits, but Matthew sensed that the Swede had been especially demoralized. Jan had been dispirited and crankier than ever since their talk at the river, when Matthew had made it clear that he wanted no part of an attempted escape. Of course, Matthew had kept their discussion to himself. But strangely enough, the guards seemed to have picked up on Jan's mood and were watching him more closely. Perhaps the guerrillas were experienced enough to sense when a prisoner was plotting an escape. Or, Matthew feared, maybe they'd overheard him and Jan talking. "Stop here!" shouted Joaquin. The human chain came to a halt. The guerrillas dropped their packs and began to make camp. It was a suitable place, firm ground, not the swampy mosses they'd struggled through for the past hour. A thick canopy of trees overhead concealed them from sight. There were plenty of dead branches around for a fire, though it wasn't essential that they make one. It was noticeably less chilly here than at their other camp. All day long they'd climbed and descended along narrow mountain paths, but the net result was a slightly lower altitude. One of the gorillas was in shirt sleeves, but that was a little crazy. A machismo thing. The guards barked out orders in Spanish, and the prisoners were broken into three groups. Matthew and the Swede found a couple of large rocks to sit on beneath a tree. Jan asked,
"Interesting. The way they always keep you and me together.
We're easier to guard this way.
But look how they break up the lot of us."
"Seems logical. The Japanese couple is married. The Spanish speakers are with the Spanish speakers, and you and I speak English."
"It has nothing to do with language, fisherman. Both the Colombian men speak English. You and I are the troublemakers. That's why we're together."
"Is that something you figured out by yourself?"
"Yes. And the sooner you figure it out, the better off you'll be."
Matthew sensed that Jan was going to raise the E-word again, escape. "I told you, you're on your own."
"Yeah, that's what the Colombian said, too."
"You talked to Emilio?"
"Of course. Haven't you noticed the guards swarming all over me for the past 3 days? Emilio tipped them off."
"Emilio's no snitch.
Like hell. Why do you think he got a new pair of boots for today's march? No one else got so much as a clean pair of socks."
"They gave him new boots because he needed them."
"I keep telling you, fisherman, it's every man for himself here. Can't you see that we have to do something?"
Matthew didn't answer. He glanced toward a group of gorillas sharing a tin of sausages and some white beans. The prisoners hadn't eaten a thing since breakfast, half a cup of coffee and a handful of cold rice. Matthew had forgotten how it had felt not to be hungry.
"Open your eyes," Jan continued. "They've got too many prisoners. They can't even feed all of us, let alone guard us. Either we make a run for it, or it's like the flea man said, they'll whittle down the group one way or another. We'll both end up dead like Will."
"Nobody's going to end up like Will, unless we do something stupid."
"You're wrong. In their eyes, you and I are exactly like Will. If they can't make a quick buck off us, we're not worth the trouble. The docile ones like the flea man, they'll keep forever, but guys like us, it's fish or cut bait. You can relate to that one, can't you, fisherman?"
"You're paranoid."
"It's the way these gorillas think. They're bored, and we're their entertainment. They got rid of Will, and pretty soon they'll decide that somebody else is trouble and needs to go."
"So what are you saying? I'm next?"
"No. Clearly it's me. But once I'm gone, it's only a matter of time before they take care of you."
"They're not going to kill me and give up a ransom."
"Don't kid yourself. That Japanese couple is loaded, and the Japanese have a reputation for always paying. Joaquin doesn't need your ransom. One snag in the negotiations, he'll kill you for the fun of it."
Up ahead, the scouts emerged from the jungle and reported to Joaquin. Apparently they'd found what they were looking for. Two guards approached the Japanese couple. Joaquin and three others came for Matthew and Jan.
"What now?" said Jan.
"We're going for a walk," said Joaquin.
"Where?"
"You'll see."
They walked single file with the Japanese prisoners toward a densely forested part of the jungle. It was more overgrown and much darker than anything they'd covered all day. An animal growled from somewhere in the thicket, and the Japanese woman clung to her husband. He sniped at Joaquin in Japanese, and the tone, if not the words, conveyed his message. From behind, a gorilla shoved him and brandished his weapon, threatening him into silence. The mysterious animal growled again. Hundreds of birds suddenly exploded from the tree branches high overhead. It was nearly deafening, the flutter of wings and all that screeching and cawing. They warned of danger. Unfazed, Joaquin and his two machete-wielding scouts led them deeper into the jungle, brushing back bamboo stalks and droopy green elephant ear plants. Five armed gorillas followed closely behind the prisoners. Matthew wasn't sure what was going on. It seemed odd that the three Colombian prisoners had been left behind.
"Stop,"
Joaquin said. They'd reached a clearing at the edge of a cliff. A canyon stretched before them, a huge gorge with steep walls that descended at least 700 feet. A muddy river snaked tortuously below, its raging waters the only audible sound in the valley. With this view, Matthew gained a full appreciation of Colombia's nickname, the Tibet of the Andes. He focused on what at first glance looked like a huge bird swooping across the canyon, and then he realized it was a man, carrying a pig. A steel cable stretched from one side of the mountain to the other, which Matthew hadn't noticed right away because it was covered in part by a low-hanging cloud. The man was seated in a rope sling, zipping across the canyon on a simple pulley and tackle system, easily topping 35 miles per hour. He was just 50 feet away from the cliff's edge and closing fast. The cable whined as he applied the brake, a crude wooden fork that the rider squeezed to create friction. The added weight of the pig had given him too much momentum, and he slammed into a wall of old tires that brought him to an abrupt stop. He picked himself up, and he and his pig scampered away without fuss, as if this were just an everyday trip from the market in a country with too few roads and bridges. Matthew watched as one of the gorillas strapped himself into the sling on a parallel cable that sloped in the opposite direction for return traffic. He pushed himself off the cliff, shouting like a bungee jumper as he sped away on the steel cable, hanging perilously above a river that churned 200 meters below and finally disappearing into the thick white cloud that filled the valley. "What do you make of this?" Matthew whispered.
"I don't know," Jan said under his breath. "But I wouldn't count on it being good."
Matthew exchanged a wary glance with the Japanese prisoners, nervously waiting his turn. Chapter 33. Matthew could not believe his eyes. After crossing the canyon, they'd walked for 20 minutes, mostly uphill, along a narrow and at times overgrown jungle path. The last 100-yard stretch had been downright frightening. The path was at its narrowest along the edge of a steep cliff. The rocks were slippery, the footing unsure. Any lapse in concentration could have meant a 200-foot drop straight down into the ravine, instant death. But finally, they'd reached their destination, a surprising reward.
"Will you look at that?" said Matthew.
Before them was a large pond, a warm and wet hole in the jungle canopy where the sun streamed in. Clouds of steam wafted up from the calm, flat waters. Matthew could feel the heat in the soles of his shoes, and each step toward the water brought the audible crunch of ancient volcanic cinders beneath the overgrowth of fallen jungle foliage, grass, and mosses that had gathered over the centuries. Joaquin had brought them to an extinct crater, a tiny geothermal paradise where nature warmed the waters to bath temperature. To a man who hadn't bathed in weeks, this was heaven on earth.
"You have 10 minutes. "'said Joaquin. "'Head above water at all times. "'If we lose sight of any one of you, we shoot everyone.'
"'The gorillas positioned themselves "'at evenly spaced intervals along the water's edge. "'The prisoners looked at each other with some humility. "'Without words, Matthew and Jan agreed not to lay eyes on the woman. "'Matthew removed his clothes eagerly "'and immersed himself up to his neck. "'On so many levels it was sensual overload, "'and for the first time in nearly a month he was actually smiling.' The waters warmed him to his core, soothing the elbows, wrists, and other joints that ached from cold and wet mountain air. He would have loved to dunk his head under and swim to the bottom, but he didn't doubt for a minute that Joaquin would commence fire on him and the others the instant he disappeared from view. He swam the breaststroke, the first exercise he'd had since jumping off the boat in Cartagena, and the thought of Cartagena brought him back to reality. Here he was, frolicking in the warm waters, almost grateful to Joaquin. Gratitude was the last thing he should have been feeling. He could never let himself forget that his Nicaraguan friends, Hector and his son Ivan, were dead at the hands of this monster. Floating on his back, Matthew glanced toward Joaquin on the shoreline. They didn't make eye contact. The gorilla was fixated on the naked Japanese woman, having positioned himself perfectly for a peep show. 10 minutes passed quickly. Joaquin called them back to shore. Matthew swam as close in as possible, then rose and ran to his clothes on the rocks. Jan was right behind him. The warm waters had turned his pasty pallor pink, and the air felt very cold. 10 meters to their left, the Japanese couple helped each other to shore. The woman covered herself quickly, still enduring the weight of Joaquin's stare.
"Leave the old clothes," shouted Joaquin.
They stopped dressing. One of the other guerrillas came forward and gave each of them clean trousers and a warm shirt. The Japanese bowed and thanked him profusely. Even Jan muttered a reluctant, "Gracias." Matthew just took the clothes, in no mood to thank a murdering kidnapper for the necessities of life. They dressed quickly, and Matthew was happy to leave his smelly garments behind. He hated to indulge himself in false hopes, but one thought consumed him. Could this mean they're letting us go? Instantly, thoughts of Kathy flooded his mind. He wondered how his wife was handling the pregnancy, if she was showing it, if she'd started decorating the baby's room. He wondered if she'd received any of the late-night messages he'd tried to convey through nothing more than mind power. He had no idea if telepathy worked, but it was all he had, and he concentrated very hard when he told her that he loved her every night. He thought of Nick and Lindsay, too, but that was risky. He'd made mistakes with his children, and the memories weren't always pleasant. A guerrilla camp in the mountains was no place for regrets, not for a man who knew that he might never even see his family again, let alone make things right. Matthew was buttoning his new shirt, then froze. In all the excitement over new clothes, he hadn't noticed the dozen new guerrillas who descended upon them. Matthew didn't recognize any of them as being from Joaquin's group, though they were all just as young and dressed similarly in fatigues, bandanas, and a variety of hats. It was a goofy thought, but Matthew was suddenly reminded of the Friday's restaurant chain in the States, where all the waiters wore the same uniforms but showed their individuality through hat selection. These new guys could have been FARC, but the dragon insignia was conspicuously absent.
"I think they're ELN," said Jan.
Over dinner one night, Emilio had told Matthew about the National Liberation Army, or ELN, Colombia's other major Marxist guerrilla organization, second in strength to FARC and equally prolific at the kidnapping trade. Crossing the canyon by cable had evidently taken the prisoners into the ELN's territory.
"What do they want?"
asked Matthew, in a voice just loud enough for Jan to hear him.
"Us."
Matthew finished buttoning his shirt, watching the guerrillas closely. Joaquin was talking intensely with one of the ELN, a short guy with a thick black mustache. He and Joaquin were the only two guerrillas in the entire group who looked to be over the age of 20. They spoke back and forth for several minutes, and then, finally, Joaquin brought him and two other ELN guerrillas down toward the prisoners. The ELN guy strutted past Matthew, then Jan, then the Japanese. He stopped before each of them, glanced up and down, then moved to the next, as if he were General Patton inspecting his troops. When he'd finished, he and Joaquin walked to one side and continued their discussion.
"Joaquin's selling us," said Jan. "That's why he gave us all a bath and cleaned us up."
The thought of being spiffed up like a used car before trade-in infuriated Matthew. "He tried to sell me once before to FARC."
"You better hope the ELN gives him his price. If he gets the idea that you're unsaleable, that's not a good thing."
"I don't need that kind of trouble."
"We're already in trouble. I've said it all along. We're too many for Joaquin to handle. If ELN won't give him his price, he'll have to get rid of at least one of us."
"Maybe he'll turn one of the women loose."
"Dream on, fisherman. It's going to be either you or me, and he isn't going to sell us off too cheap, and he isn't turning anyone loose."
From a distance, Matthew watched Joaquin more closely. The discussion with the ELN leader was well out of earshot, but they were standing in the open, and Joaquin was waving his arms with emotion. It was clear from the expression on his face that the negotiations weren't going his way. Finally, Joaquin shouted something in anger and stormed away.
"Vamos!"
he told his men. The guerrillas rounded up the prisoners. Without another word to the ELN, they headed back into the jungle, single file, down the same path that had brought them there. No one talked except Joaquin, who was cursing FARC and the ELN for their greediness. He was fuming. And as they continued down the overgrown path, it made everyone edgy, even the other guerrillas. The path was becoming treacherous. The footing was unsure, and a misty rain made the rocks even more slippery than on the way up.
The warm waters of the pond had actually made Matthew's legs rubbery, and after a full day of marching, fatigue was taking its toll. He forced himself to concentrate, especially on this narrow stretch of path along the cliff with the deep ravine below. For some reason, going down was proving to be more difficult than climbing up. The grade seemed steeper on the descent, and if you focused on the river 200 feet below, vertigo could easily overtake you. The group proceeded one at a time. Three gorillas went first to show the prisoners the proper technique. They didn't walk straight down the path, but took half steps sideways with their backs to the cliff and their chests toward the mountainside. Two hands were on the face of the mountain at all times. Next, it was Matthew's turn. Despite the danger and his need to focus, he couldn't clear his mind of a terrible sinking sensation. He remembered what Emilio had told him after the FARC deal had fallen through. The worst place for a kidnapped victim to be was with a rogue criminal like Joaquin. The survival rate was better with an established Marxist group that had the resources to hold prisoners for longer periods of time. A scream pierced the jungle, the desperate cry of a dying man. It was hard to tell where it had come from. Matthew could have sworn it was below him. Confused, he hurried ahead to the base of the narrow pass. He looked back and saw Jan, the Swede, and he was immediately concerned. The order of descent had been Matthew, the Japanese man, and then Jan. Behind Jan was Nisho, the Japanese woman. She was hysterical. One of the gorillas grabbed her and carried her down the rest of the way. Two other gorillas were at the cliff's edge. Matthew hurried over and looked down into the ravine. The Japanese man lay dead, face down, his body smashed on the rocks near the river 100 feet below. The wife was screaming inconsolably. Grief was what Matthew thought at first, but she was swinging wildly and cursing in Japanese, seemingly more angry than anguished. One gorilla wasn't enough to control her. Two others finally came over to subdue her. Joaquin was last on the scene, having doubled back from his lead position. ¿Qué pasó? What happened? Jan answered quickly. El americano le empujó. Nisho was still screaming wildly, and Matthew wasn't sure if he'd heard Jan quite right. I pushed him? He said, incredulous. Two gorillas grabbed him. No, no, said Matthew. Sí, sí, said Jan. Matthew le empujó. Matthew locked eyes with the Swede. In a flash, that earlier nervous talk of Joaquin's having more prisoners than he could handle came back to Matthew, and he realized what Jan had done. Some prisoners needed to be eliminated, and Jan had made sure that he wouldn't be one of them. The crying widow was fighting to break free of the gorilla's grasp, trying to crawl on her hands and knees to the cliff's edge to see or perhaps join her fallen husband. The gorillas restrained her to the point of exhaustion, but the wailing continued. Joaquin had fire in his eyes as he walked up to Matthew and, without warning, delivered a monstrous sucker punch to the solar plexus. Matthew doubled over, sucking air, but the gorillas held him up, forcing him to stand on his own 2 feet. He's lying, said Matthew, barely able to speak. You're lying, said Joaquin. He grabbed Matthew by the hair and yanked him straight up to the standing position. And don't think you won't pay for this. He unleashed another blow to the same spot. Matthew went down onto his knees, gasping for air. Another gorilla kicked him from behind, an army boot directly into his left kidney, which sent him sprawling face first into the dirt. Matthew coiled into the fetal position to fend off any further blows. He could hardly breathe, and the dizziness was making it almost impossible to see. Mustering all his remaining strength, he managed to turn his sights on the Swede, but his fellow captive just looked away. Jan had been saying it for days, though Matthew hadn't wanted to believe him. Now he knew it was true. They were becoming their own Pitcairn Island. It was every man for himself. Chapter 34. The Miami-Dade County Courthouse was practically ancient by Miami standards, an imposing stone tower and distinctive bump on the city's modern skyline. My first visit had been on a field trip in middle school, though it wasn't the massive fluted columns or tiered granite steps that had impressed me so much I decided to become a lawyer. It was the unbridled energy, the almost perpetual state of confusion. On Tuesday morning, it was abuzz with the usual chaos. From every direction, swarms of people converged on the main entrance, squeezed through the metal detectors, and then raced across the lobby for a spot on a slow-moving elevator that would eventually land them before one of 23 judges on 15 floors. It was a non-stop stream of lawyers and litigants, witnesses and jurors, court employees and members of the media. Thrown into the mix were the venerable retirees who had nothing better to do than pack a liverwurst sandwich into a paper sack and head over to Flagler Street to enjoy the real-life version of the People's Court. They were like unofficial court historians, capable of rattling off stories about the Giants in Miami's trial bar, the way baseball fans knew the legends of the sport. For them, trial was theater. At times, the theater of the absurd, and the longest-running show around was right here in this old building. A few could even wax nostalgic about the old days when the courthouse also served as a stockade, well before my time. Criminal cases were no longer heard here. These days, the docket was strictly civil. Civil, that wasn't exactly the word that came to mind as I braced for the sight of Duncan Fitz as opposing counsel. The hearing was scheduled for 9 a.m. before Judge Corvan, roughly 16 hours after I'd been served with the papers. I was well aware of the old adage that a lawyer who represents himself has a fool for a client. And I had considered asking the judge to postpone the hearing. But searching for a lawyer and then bringing him up to speed on the facts would only have delayed matters. My father needed someone to get before a judge and plead the family's case as quickly as possible, and I knew the case better than anyone. At least for round one, I was on my own. I was the last to arrive at Judge Corvan's chambers. Duncan Fitz and his New York partner, Maggie Johans, were seated on the battered plaid couch in the waiting room. They probably would have shaken my hand if I'd offered it. The hypocrites. Maggie wasn't a trial lawyer, so I assumed she was here not in her capacity.